Today is Wednesday, July 26, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I am an interviewer for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Mary Behan, professor in the Comparative Biosciences Department of the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Hello.
Hi.
The first question that we're going to start with is if you would talk about where and when you were born, talk about your childhood, your early education, any people that had an influenced you in terms of going on to school and what you wanted to do for the rest of your life.
Certainly. I was born in 1950 in Drogheda, Ireland. Drogheda is about 30 miles north of Dublin, and it's a somewhat nondescript small industrial town, maybe 25,000 people. My parents were both dentists, and this was rather unusual, at least for my mother, because she would have been one of the first and one of the youngest dentists in Ireland. And Ireland in the 50s was a rather depressed, virtually third world country, very much not sure of its position in society. My childhood was great. I had one sibling, 2 years older than me, a sister, and I went to the local school, which was run by nuns, of course, and then at age 11 I went to a boarding school. Most children in our town who came from professional families were sent to boarding schools, either in Dublin or elsewhere in the country. And the boarding school I went to was called Loretto Abbey Rathfarnham. It was run by Loretto nuns. And Loretto nuns considered themselves the female equivalent of the Jesuits. Give us a child and we can shape them. And the convent that I went to had 150 girls spanning the ages 11 to 17 and 300 nuns, because it happened to be the mother order of that particular order, the mother house. So it had the old folks home and it had the novitiate where young nuns came in, hence the large numbers. So the student to nun ratio was very good for something or other. It was a very strict boarding school, and once you went in September, you didn't get out again until Christmas. You didn't go home for weekends, and it was a very strictly religious boarding school as well. But I got an incredible education, because most of the nuns in that order were themselves educated, had college degrees, and their idea was that you would be as well educated as they possibly could achieve. So they had very high standards, and we spent an awful lot of time studying and were exposed to a broad range of topics, including science. And as a result, I was fond of science. And my sister went to college 2 years before me, and she went into science. And it seemed like she was enjoying it, so I thought, okay, I'll do science. My parents were not encouraging of me going into dentistry. They felt it was a tough career for a woman, and it was. It was very hard to make your way as a woman in dentistry, and my mother didn't practice much, because in a small town, the man had the job, and the woman had to do whatever she could, small jobs here and there. So she did locums and she did, you know, children's tooth straightening. But nobody had much money in Ireland in the 50s and 60s. So unfortunately, her career was not very well developed. So as I say, I followed my sister into science and I loved it. Science in Ireland, you know, they took 500 into the first year science class in the fall, and probably 60% of those got through their first year. You had a chance to repeat. You got one chance to repeat. If you succeeded, you got back into college, and if you failed, that was it. That was your chance for college. So it was a very much, you jumped this hurdle, it's this high, and if you don't, well, find a different career. I did fine.
What college did you attend?
I went to University College Dublin, mm-hmm. which was the main college of the National University. The National University had a college in Dublin, a college in Cork, and a college in Galway. The alternative was Trinity College Dublin, which was considered the Protestant university in Dublin. And up to the time I went to university, if you were Catholic, you had to get a dispensation to go to Trinity College because it was considered godless by comparison with the National University. So I went into college, and I never noticed it at the time, but as I look back, I realize the professor in zoology was a woman. The professor in the Department of Botany was a woman. The professor in the Department of Chemistry was a woman. And there were many of my lecturers who were female. So I never considered that I couldn't do anything I wanted to do. And my parents had emphasized having a career, that that would be the most important thing that my sister and I would do. We had to have a career. My mother was rather blunt. She said, you know, men are wonderful, but they can die on you. And although my father, you know, lived to his 70s, I recognize her sense of, you can only trust your own abilities. You are responsible for yourself. And the nuns would have endorsed that as well.
Mm-hmm. Was it general science that you majored in then when you were in college?
In Ireland at that time, when you went into science, you had to choose. Well, remember, in high school, even in junior school, you had to make some choices. As early as 11 or 12 years of age, I had to make choices to either go into the humanities or into science. You either kept Latin and math and took science and let go history and geography and art, or you went the other way. So you streamed at an early age. Mm-hmm. When you got to college, you picked 4 out of 6 science subjects. So I picked botany, zoology, chemistry, and math. After your first year, you drop one subject. So I was down to botany, zoology, and in fact, biochemistry. And then in third year, you either took a general degree or you elected one subject you would specialize in for an honors degree. And I elected to take zoology. So I got an honors degree in zoology. So my fourth year in college was all zoology. And I've never had a class at a college level in the humanities. Fortunately, I had a very good high school education, so I'm not a total disaster when it comes to art, art history, politics, economics, whatever.
Was the expectation that you would go on to school for a graduate degree, or did you assume some kind of career would come up when you graduated?
That's a great question, and I think I assumed some sort of career would come up. I was eyeing my sister ahead of me and seeing what she did, and she chose to go to Canada to do a master's degree, came back to Ireland for a year, and then went back to Canada to do a PhD at McGill. So I think at that stage I had at least the notion that I could go to graduate school somewhere. As it turned out, I had a boyfriend in Ireland and he wasn't leaving, so I stayed around and I went to graduate school at the same university where I did my undergraduate degree. And that wasn't too unusual in Ireland at the time. And the nice thing was that the state paid for it. If your undergraduate degree was of high quality, if you got a first-class honors, your graduate training was totally paid for. So I had a marvelous graduate environment, a small stipend, I suppose I was dirt poor, but it seemed like a fortune. And I had a great time as a graduate student.
Talk about it. What was great?
I think as I look back on it, most people went through grad school in Ireland in three and a half years, they got their PhD. I got involved in politics, and it was left-wing politics. I couldn't discuss it with my parents, oh my God, no. So this was Sinn Féin, the Workers' Party. This was going to be the vanguard of the Republican movement, and we were going to save the world. And I got exposed to it through the infamous boyfriend, but I also, when we broke up, I stayed with Sinn Féin, the Workers' Party. I was from the upper middle class, and my parents would have been quite conservative. they were willing to let me go a certain distance. For example, they let me hitchhike around Europe when I was 18. But their politics was well formed. And I saw the world as being rather unfair. And I had got a bigger slice of the pie than most people. And I felt I should be more aware of the small pie slices. And I worked, you know, in community situations, free legal aid, going door to door campaigning against joining the EU, which of course, European Union, which as I look back on it was, fortunately, I failed because it was wonderful for Ireland. But at the time it seemed it was going to change the shape of the country. And most of the people I met in this political movement were working class through and through. And they were very suspicious of me, this upper class little one coming in to their environment. So I got a few hard knocks in that experience.
Was it dangerous at all?
Sinn Féin was a political organization that was recognized by the government. Sinn Féin had another side to it, which was a military group that was not recognized by the government, and that was the Irish Republican Army, the IRA. And I didn't have any connections with that, but I was pretty sure that many of the people I rubbed shoulders with in Sinn Féin were also in the IRA. So to me, there wasn't any danger. The only danger was if you were in a protest outside someone's house, you might get arrested because the police didn't care whether you were Sinn Féin or IRA. And I do remember one time coming home from judo practice that I had to go to in the middle of this demonstration. I had to go off to judo practice. And when I came back, there was nobody left demonstrating. They'd all been arrested. And I just thought, oh, thank heavens, because if my parents saw my name on the front page of the newspaper, they would have killed me. Or maybe they knew in any case. But it was a great experience because I got politics out of my system. I continued to vote. I have very strong political opinions, but I don't need to participate anymore. And I admire people who participate at that grassroots level. For the huge, endless efforts they put in for so little reward. I really think the world of them. But I don't need to do it anymore, but it was a marvelous experience. So my PhD took 5 years instead of 3 or 3.5. But I learned a lot more than science.
Well, what did you learn in science?
So in science, my PhD advisor got me sort of by default. I didn't really particularly want to work on that project or work with him. He didn't particularly want to work with me, but we ended up with each other because there weren't many choices. And I was his first PhD student, and I was probably a very challenging one. He had come back from the States, he had just done his postdoc, he got a new faculty job, and he got me. And I was very opinionated, very independent, demanding, and as I think back on it, oh, the poor man. And I didn't have a lot of respect for him, which, as I look back now, was probably warranted in light of everything that I know about him and I know about me. He wasn't a very good scientist, and he wasn't a very good major professor. And his inadequacies, he wasn't able to own up to them or get help. So I pretty much muddled along by myself a lot. Now, in fairness, he kept me, and he kept working on this project, and the project was successful in the end. We got lots of publications out of it. But I didn't feel that I learned so much from him. I did much of the work at Trinity College, actually. I went to a lab there and said, I need to do X. We don't have the equipment, can you help me? And they were wonderful. And then I went to a lab in Northern Ireland, in a university in Northern Ireland for several months with the same thing. We didn't have the equipment, and I asked them, could I use their equipment? And they said, sure, and you can come stay with us. Only I had to drive up and down to Northern Ireland from Dublin in the middle of the Troubles. So you'd be stopped at army patrols and told to either take cover because there was a skirmish going on up ahead of you, or else get out of the car and be searched thoroughly through and through. So it was it was exciting. You know, you're 21 or 22, you're invincible. You can go anywhere and do anything.
What was the project?
The project was actually looking at sensory structures on the mouth parts or on the back end of insects. So the back end being the egg-laying apparatus of a female insect. How does she know where to lay her eggs? She actually pokes around with her butt, and she has sensory receptors on it, and they tell her if the environment is appropriate or not. Is it the right side of a leaf she's laying her legs on, for example? And the front end, obviously, they're looking to find the right food. And if they're a larva, they don't have a lot going on, but they're looking to make sure that they can get to the carrot, which was the insects I was involved in were pests, agricultural pests. So I did a lot of electron microscopy, and that was my major skill as I left with a PhD. And when I started to look for postdocs, and I knew that you had to do a postdoc, in Ireland at that time, you had to leave. It was the 70s. So to get experience, you had to go away for one or more years before you could come back and get a job in Ireland. That was the sort of current wisdom in science at the time. So most of my colleagues knew we were going to be leaving, emigrating, and likely we'd come back after a few years. Only I didn't.
Well, where did you go?
My first postdoc, I had written to various people who were in my field, you know, cold letters saying, I'd like to come work with you. And I didn't know how the system worked, but I sent a letter to a man in Princeton, and he wrote back saying, yes, I'd be very interested in having you come to my lab, but I'm leaving actually. I'm going to Amherst, Massachusetts. So you have a choice. You could stay with a colleague of mine at Princeton, or you could go to Amherst. I took that letter and showed it to some friends and said, what's New Jersey like? And they said, well, it's the armpit of the United States. I remember that phrase. And then I said, well, what's Massachusetts like? And they said, oh, it's very like Ireland. So, of course, that was an easy choice. I went to UMass Amherst, and I didn't go to Princeton. And, you know, these are the things that change your life, but you don't know it at the time. Because, you know, one road leads you one place, and another, a totally different life. So I went to UMass Amherst, and I was a new emigrant, and I loved the United States. I adored it. It was everything that I wanted. It was far enough away from my parents that I couldn't be found out if I had done anything, and everything was available to me to do. Anything in the world I wanted to try, I could see that I could do it. Not just in science, but also in play. You know, I had my first pizza, for heaven's sake, in the United States. You could order it. My God, what an amazing idea, and they'd bring it to you. If you wanted to try ice skating, you could do it. You could get on skis. You know, these were all things I didn't have in Ireland. In Ireland, I had judo, which was pretty cool in Ireland, but there were so many opportunities, and I tried loads of them. So I had a year and a bit at UMass Amherst. And the funding for that postdoc was limited. And also, I was on one of these J-1 visas from a country that had an exchange with the United States and a payback agreement, which meant I had to leave the United States and go back to Ireland to pay back an equivalent amount of time. But around that time, Ireland had entered the European Union, and suddenly it was part of a bigger family, and the payback was less clear, and the payback in Ireland was not clear at all. So I worked on the assumption I could pay back anywhere in Europe. So I found another postdoc in Holland. And again, I wrote to somebody in Holland and said, I'd like to come work with you, and he took me. So that was a small town in Holland, a small agricultural university. Again, a wonderful experience. I arrived in Holland with a car, a bicycle, and I stayed in a hostel for foreigners at this university, where I was probably one of two women in maybe 100 guys that came from very third world countries who were learning agricultural techniques. And, you know, you'd be accosted in the bar of this hostel with somebody saying, you like babies? You knit? You sew? You can cook? I mean, your marriage prospects were just overwhelming. And finally, when they got to the, you like babies, I'd always say no. That always worked. I could agree, I knitted and sewed and cooked, but no babies. So I had a good experience there for a year, but I wanted to get back to the United States.
Now, were you still working on insects at
yes,
that time?
Yes, I was still working on insects at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was scouring Science magazine, looking for opportunities back in the United States, postdocs there. And at the same time, I was keeping my hand in Europe, in this insect group, and looking for opportunities there, and looking back at Ireland, where there were no opportunities. So I applied for another postdoc, one in Seewiesen, in southern Germany, in Bavaria, which was the mecca for insect behavior at that time. And I saw a job advertised in University of Wisconsin in Madison. They wanted somebody to do electron microscopy in cat visual system. Hadn't a clue about cat visual system. I'd never worked on a vertebrate, but it didn't matter. I applied for it. And the reason was, I had been to Madison once before. So when I was in Amherst, Massachusetts, my major professor from graduate school did a sabbatical in Madison, Wisconsin. And I visited him to work on a manuscript. And he had come to do a sabbatical here in Madison because he once shared an office with an American at University College Dublin who was doing a sabbatical on deer herds in Ireland. And that professor was a well-known professor of wildlife ecology in Madison, Wisconsin. So, the circles, the circles, the circles. So in any case, I visited Madison in summer.
Now what year was this?
This would have been 1976. I drove out to Madison from Amherst. And I arrived to the terrace. And the terrace in summer in 1976 looked as wonderful as it does now in 2006. I couldn't believe it. It looked like a holiday camp. And it was just the most gorgeous place. Amherst was pretty nice, but Madison was just breathtaking. So I spent a couple of days working on the manuscript and drove back, but never forgot about Madison. And, you know, as I say, things come around years later that you never know. So in Holland, I got a phone call and a letter within the space of 24 hours. The letter came second. It was an offer to go to Seewiesen in Germany. The phone call came first. It was an offer to come to Madison, Wisconsin and do a postdoc on cat visual system in the Department of Anatomy with John Harting. John Harting had never met me. He had my CV, but his grandmother was Irish. And he told me afterwards the reason I got the job was because I was Irish. So that was it. Huh. So in short order, I left Holland and I moved to Madison, Wisconsin, where I arrived in winter. And things were a lot different. But I started a postdoc in 1978 with John Harting in the Department of Anatomy. So that was my arrival to Madison.
Uh-huh. Then, and you've been here ever since?
Ever since.
All right. Then how did you get your faculty position?
Well, I worked with John for a couple of years, and I enjoyed what I was doing, and I learned a huge amount. And John was very encouraging in as much as he suggested that I learn how to teach gross anatomy, human gross anatomy, a very saleable thing, which was good advice. And that I learn how to teach human neuroanatomy to medical students. Again, very good advice. John and I had, let's say, our ups and downs in terms of our relationship, and we're really good friends now. But as I look back on me, I probably was a bit of a challenge in 1978 as a postdoc. And so at some point we parted company, and I spent a year working in Ron Khalil's lab. Ron is in the Department of Ophthalmology, professor there. So I postdoc with him. During that time, the vet school was getting on its feet. Legislation had gone through. The university was going to have a school of veterinary medicine, and they needed to hire a new faculty, and the building was being built. And I remember going by the building, looking at it, and I knew they were hiring, and thinking, I would give body parts to get a job in that school of veterinary medicine, because I'd been in Madison for 2 years, and I adored it. I had started to look for faculty jobs. I knew I was staying in the United States. And at the same time, I wanted more than anything to stay at Madison. So the job applications came out, and Ron Khalil said to me, have you put in your application? I said, yes. And I got an interview. Now, it didn't go totally smoothly, because they interviewed three people for the job I have now. And they didn't hire any of them. And I wasn't one of those interviewees the first time round. And they interviewed three more people, two friends of mine and me. And I got the job. Ironically, my two friends who interviewed for the job have stayed in Madison and got other jobs. So it isn't as if, you know, life went bad for them. And we stayed friends. But I got it. And, you know, I remember the day of my interview. Things were leaner then. The interview, well, lunch was at McDonald's. I remember where I gave my seminar, which is in the current Animal Health and Biomedical Sciences, their conference room. And I remember the interview afterwards, the various people questioning me and asking me, could I teach X? Gross anatomy, yes. Even if it was animals instead of humans, of course I said yes. And then, could I teach neuro? And I said, yes. Could I teach histo? Yes. And they looked at me and said, how about biochemistry? And I went, no. But I'd try. I really wanted the job. So I got it. And that was the start of my faculty life here.
What was it like coming in at the beginning then of the School of Veterinary Medicine? That must have been really interesting.
I think anyone from that period of time will tell you it was incredibly exciting. Our first location, we didn't have a building open when we were hired, so we had office space in the old Rennebaum building, which is opposite the old medical school, the old hospital. And we had an apartment. I remember we had a bedroom, kitchen, sitting room, and bathroom. And I shared it with two of my colleagues in my department. One is now retired, Inge Keith, and the other, Gordon Mitchell, is my chairman in the department now. And we converted the bedroom, obviously, to an office. But we joked about it because you had a full kitchen, so, you know, you could work there 24/7. I remember one time walking down the corridor and seeing the janitor, as I thought, sweeping the floors in this Rennebaum building. Now, there were only 10 people on the faculty at this time. We had a dean and we had a secretary and a couple of chairs. And I thought this guy was the janitor. He was in a check shirt and he was sweeping the floor. It turned out he was Dick Bristol, the associate dean for clinical affairs. In other words, we did everything. And when we moved to the new building, we were like kids. You know, this is my new office. This is my new lab. Who are you? Because something like 70, 75 people were all hired at the same time. So we created a school and were willing to do anything. We chaired committees that we didn't even know what the committees were meant to be doing. But we just, we were well mentored and we were willing to do anything to make it work. And we were all, for the most part, here for about a year before the first class came in. And the first class was also willing to do anything to make it work. It really was an adventure for everyone, and we all felt like pioneers.
What was the tenure process like?
I think the best thing to say about the tenure process is, back to mentoring, my chairman, Jerry Biscard, hired 12 or so faculty. We were somewhat similar in age, the faculty he hired. He would have been only 8, 10 years older than us at best. And he hired two senior faculty members, Norm Wilsman and John Oakes. John has just retired, Norm is still in the department. And the three of them were our mentors. So they pretty much every year met with us to look at our portfolios and see where we're making progress toward tenure. At that time, the university didn't have a formal mentoring process the way they do now, and the Women's Faculty Mentoring Program didn't exist. But within the vet school, we had a superb mentoring system that was very effective, and everyone in my department was tenured. I think we all felt that it was a big hurdle, but that if we went ahead doing what we were doing as well as we were doing it, we would probably get there, as opposed to anything being a surprise or a shock. It was a very iterative, progressive process where you every year went through everything you had done and added it to your collection, your list. And so when it came time for tenure, I knew that it was something that there was a chance I wouldn't get it. But at the same time, I had done my best and I couldn't have done more or been helped better. And fortunately, I did get it, so it worked out okay. But I do remember probably 3 months before my tenure document went in, and it was ready. I'm always ready a month or so early. I took a vacation. Well, Pakistan wouldn't be the first choice of most people, but I'd read in the New York Times that the Karakoram Highway had just opened between northern Pakistan and China. And I wanted to be one of the first people on it. So I went to Pakistan to hitchhike the Karakoram Highway. And you had to go through the Northwest Frontier Province. And maybe I'd go into China, maybe I'd go into Afghanistan. I mean, I was totally naive. I didn't even know Pakistan was a dry country. And I enjoyed a drink. And so I told my chair I was going to Pakistan. And he looked at me and he said, "You are coming back, aren't you?" So I assured him I'd be back if all went well. Actually, there were a few times when I wondered if I'd be coming back, but it did all go well in the end, and it was it's a great set of memories.
And did you go by yourself?
Yes. Blonde-haired, blue-eyed, to northern Pakistan. And actually, ironically, the area that I traveled through is now the area that is absolutely the worst place you could be if you were from the United States, because it is exactly where Osama bin Laden is probably hiding out and hanging out. But I did see it in the good old days, 20-odd years ago.
Quite a trip. All right, so you got... The way you talk about the culture in the beginning sounds like it was pretty ideal as far as, you know, being a new faculty member coming into a new school, having the mentor program there for you, even if it wasn't a formal program, getting tenure. Has the culture changed at all over the years, and if so, how?
Let me first of all answer that question looking at it from my own department's perspective. We were a cohort that joined our department, were tenured plus or minus 3 to 5 years beside each other. And it's only in the past 6 years that we've hired a new cohort. That has been a positive and a negative, a wonderful environment, the same colleagues for many years, very similar, and our department is amazingly collegial, probably the most collegial department in the whole of the university. And I do have some experience of many other departments. Mm-hmm. We still really like each other, and everything is done by consensus. We have hired junior faculty, three of them, who would agree with that and fit this culture very well. We've not hired people who don't fit. So we're sort of perpetuating ourselves. I think there are pluses and minuses in that, because sometimes departments, great departments, thrive on the fact that they have very big differences between the people in their department, and that constant edginess and foment can create pluses as well as minuses, great pluses as well as great minuses. So I would say our amplitude in simple harmonic motion is lower than other places, but our harmony is great. In terms of the school, there have been more changes, particularly in the clinical departments, with faculty, some of the early hires leaving pre-tenure, because it was a tough place to get tenure. particularly for clinical faculty who didn't have good research experience in their training. I'd say that if you're hired here now, you don't know everybody, and at a time when we were hired, we did know everybody because we'd a long time to get to know one another. So it's a little bit more dispersed in the school than it was in the past. But overall, I think that there is still a huge amount of collegiality. We share well, it's a small building, and we have to share well because we don't have a lot of space. And I know that because I'm chair of the space committee now, and we don't have a lot of space. So there's still a lot of a strong sense of having to work together. And perhaps one of the things that truly made a difference, our first dean, Barney Easterday, in designing the layout of this building. Well, the architects laid it out in a certain sense, but Barney suggested that faculty not be polarized into regions of the building. So your office would be adjacent to somebody who was not in your department. So for example, the first person in the office next door to me for 6, 7, 8 years was a large animal surgeon. And I learned a huge amount about the life of a clinician scientist in the vet school by having him as my office mate or a neighbor. Because you see them 24 hours a day. You see them at the odd hours. You see them smelly and dirty. You see them distressed and happy. You see what their life is like, and you have a much better understanding of how you all contribute to the mission of the school. After that, I had an oncologist, a small animal oncologist, for several years. I'm back now with a large animal, not surgeon, but large animal medicine clinician. And this has made a big difference to me, and I think it's made a big difference to all of our faculty, because you are forced, whether you like it or not, to see colleagues in other departments. We have only 4 departments, but even so, you might never see somebody if they were in the clinics most of the time. Mm-hmm. This has been very, very good for our culture.
That sounds like it would be. That's an excellent idea. Mm-hmm. What is the national reputation of the department that you're in and of the school?
I would say that the department I'm in terms of a national reputation, the metrics that are used are you a physiology department? Are you in a medical school? Are you a comparative biology department? Are you in a school of science or the like? We don't have the right comparison. If you compare us with anatomy physiology departments in medical schools, we're small and we are reasonably funded per faculty member, but we wouldn't be a shining example. If you compare us with a department of zoology, for example, we can't really be well compared with them. We're probably better funded because many of our faculty have NIH grants. So if you compare us then with departments in veterinary schools throughout the country, we would compare incredibly well. Veterinary schools, Madison is probably in the top 5. And again, it depends on what your metric is. If you look at research, Madison is probably per capita the best or in the top 2 research veterinary schools. If you compare it in terms of what is your alumni giving to your school, of course the old schools will have a much greater portfolio. And then if you compare it in terms of size, we're relatively small and our faculty is very small by comparison with Davis or with Cornell. Mm-hmm. So Davis, Cornell, Penn, North Carolina, we would all rub shoulders happily with one another. But in terms of research, I think that Madison does stand not head and shoulders, but certainly a half head above the others.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk about your research today?
Sure. I've had an interesting research career. I think most biomedical researchers have a sort of a linear career where they start on a topic in graduate school and they adhere to at least part of that throughout the rest of their life. They establish a community, they network, they surround themselves with people in the same area of interest from age perhaps 22 to when they retire. And maybe because I've changed research directions, but I think being an emigrant has contributed to this, and not having a U.S. pedigree, which definitely contributes to this. There is a them and us mentality within biomedical sciences vis-a-vis where your degree is from. And if it's not from the East Coast or the West Coast or Madison or Michigan or wherever, it better be from Oxford or London. And where in Ireland was that, you said? Oh, but you're Irish. I love your accent. So, in switching from insect research to mammalian research, I left a community that I was pretty well established in. In moving into visual research in mammals, and I worked on cats for those first few years, I did establish another community for 12, 14 years. I was funded by the NIH, and so I had that community within the National Eye Institute and colleagues around the country, and I felt pretty comfortable in it. I had a place in it. When that funding dried up, and you can, there's no point in blaming anyone. I should have been more proactive, but perhaps the area of research I was in wouldn't have been funded in the long term. But in any case, funding dried up, and I looked around to see where else could a good brain and a pair of hands and a lot of energy be applied. And I started to collaborate in other research areas. So I strayed quite a long way from the visual system. It's all a brain. And, you know, a neuron is a neuron, and it makes connections. And it doesn't much matter what system you're in as to the principles that surround this. But I spent some time working in the olfactory system, and then I ended up in the respiratory control system, so breathing. So for the past 8 to 10 years, I've been working on how the brain controls plasticity in breathing. And this has given me a new community and a new research direction. But actually, I think of all the types of research I've done, I am happiest in this area. And it's not just the community. Each of the communities has been great. I think that I have found a research question that I have oriented toward. So in working on insects, yes, I love them. I did them for PhD, but, you know, it wasn't that I thought when I was 7 I wanted to do a PhD in insect chemoreception. I've never had an idea that I wanted to do X. It was just, well, that's very interesting. Yes, well, let's see where that takes me. Now that I've arrived at this, my particular research area is, how does the brain change with age to adapt to the challenges to breathing, to the control of breathing? So the effects of age on the neural control of breathing. And with age, you have lots of changes in your body, in your lungs, in your upper airway, in your muscles, and it's harder to adapt to challenge. So, we're breathing fine. If we stop, well, that's the end of that. But respiratory challenge and how we adapt to it, I find intriguing. And males and females are different in their responses to respiratory challenge, and there are diseases of breathing that are worse in one sex versus the other. And an example is obstructive sleep apnea. So this is collapse of the upper airway during sleep. And it's a disease that affects middle-aged men by comparison with young men, and postmenopausal women by comparison with premenopausal women. So there's something going on with age, but it's clear that there's something going on with hormones, sex hormones. And so my research has broadened to look at the effects of sex hormones on the neural control of breathing and how those sex hormone effects change with age. And I think that I've arrived at an incredibly important question, because we have for years considered sex hormones as just something to do with sex. and reproduction. And in fact, sex hormones, as we're learning now in the nervous system, have an enormous impact on not just the areas that control sexual desires, for example, but have huge effects on many aspects of what the nervous system controls. And that can be mood and behavior, but it can also be something as simple and fundamental as breathing. And now, as I've established myself in this research area and got NIH funding for it, and looks like, based on the score I got about a month ago for a recent grant I submitted, with luck, I'm going to be funded for the next 4 to 5 years more. Now I have the luxury, for I'm 56, of stepping back and saying, these sex hormones, so you're interested in them in aging, well, do they have a role at birth? There's a huge testosterone surge in the fetus at birth. Is that setting up the nervous system and its ability to control respiratory challenge or to adapt to respiratory challenge? Could that be contributing to some of the developmental diseases that affect breathing? And the example, of course, is sudden infant death syndrome, which has a 2-to-1 prevalence in males, young boys, young infant males versus females. So in some ways, I'm now looking back across the age spectrum to the beginning of the age spectrum and whether sex hormones are playing a role there also. So ironically, I think now I'm doing the best research that I've ever done, and I'm probably thinking better in science than I have ever thought. And part of it is experience, part of it is just arriving at a topic that I'm female and I'm older, has complete relevance for me. And, you know, I'm postmenopausal and I actually take sex hormone supplements and have made that an active choice. So I think I'm engaged in doing something that I find relevant to me as well as relevant to humans around me. And as you'll notice, I work on a topic that's relevant to humans, despite the fact that I work in a school of veterinary medicine and my research animals are rats. But that's not uncommon, that our research topics are in human health. They may later apply to animals, they may apply to animals in certain diseases now, but rats don't have obstructive sleep apnea. So I'm not helping rats at this time, but I'm learning a lot about how aging affects the nervous system.
Now, do you collaborate with others on campus?
Yes, and one of the things I've learned about myself over the years, I'm not a brilliant scientist. I'm always in the top 25%, and I probably, short of high school, I was in the top 1% in high school. But once I got to college, I realized I was way back in that, you know, maybe scraping into the top 25%. So I'm comfortable, though I'll always strive to get back up into that top percentile. But I'm comfortable being here. But I realize that I'm so much better a scientist if I'm working with people, because what I don't understand or get or see, they will bring along in their research questions or knowledge or background. And so the two of us together, or the three of us together, are going to be way better than just me alone. And I did go it alone in visual research. I was the solo lab, the solo operator, virtually no collaborators. Once I started collaborations out of necessity, I realized the pluses and the minuses. And there are minuses, you know, personalities are challenging. But I'm a very good collaborator, and I have found fabulous collaborators on campus. And they're both males and females. They're in the medical school as well as in the School of Veterinary Medicine. And they appear easily. And ironically, as I grow older, they appear more and more easily. I could collaborate 10 times over. I have to sort of stop and say, you know, that's really interesting, but I can't get into that.
Who are they?
I started a collaboration with Lou Haberly, who's in the anatomy department. He's a professor in the anatomy department. And we worked in the olfactory system. When I arrived in Madison first, we did a project together. We separated for 20 years in terms of research ideas, and then we got back together again and published together. After that, I started to collaborate with Ruth Benke. Ruth is a professor in the medical school. She's a sleep psychiatrist, and we met each other because her graduate student was, I was on her graduate student's committee. Her graduate student was working in a brain area that I had some expertise in, and Ruth didn't. So Anne, her graduate student, brought us together. We liked each other. We got on great, and we decided to write a grant together, which we got, and we worked together for 6 or 7 years. We're not funded together right now. I think we'd both love to write another grant together, but we're both pretty busy. So we will, we have still got a paper to finish up writing together, and we are the best of friends. So I also collaborate with Nadine Connor. Nadine is an assistant professor also in the medical school, and ironically enough, again, I knew her as a graduate student here on campus, and she emerged because she works on tongue exercise and how that improves swallowing function. She and Joanne Robbins, also in the medical school. And so Nadine and I were talking about tongue exercise, and I said, well, what's happening in the brain? You know, the tongue is part of the airway. I work on airway and how the brain controls airway. What's happening in the brains of your exercised rats? And we started a collaboration. We have a student, a master's student together. We have a grant that was reviewed recently and got a score that's on the borderline. If it gets funded, we will be working together for the next 5 years. If it doesn't, we'll resubmit it. Mm-hmm. I've collaborated with my chairman a huge amount. He was in the lab next door to me, and we often wondered. He worked on spinal cord, and I wasn't interested in it. And we finally found an area, control of breathing, where we have mutual interests, and we've collaborated. He's almost always on my grants. I collaborate with Bert Olson, a professor in the medical school in population health sciences, another breathing researcher. I'm starting a collaboration with two people in my own department now, and we're going to write a grant on how hibernating squirrels versus ordinary non-hibernating squirrels can change their whole ability to breathe. In hibernation, they breathe once a minute or so. In normal life, they're breathing, you know, 60 times a minute. What changed? And why don't they die if they only breathe once a minute when they're hibernating? So we're going to write a grant together on that.
So it isn't that difficult then to find people.
Oh, no. In fact,
it's almost too easy.
It's almost too easy. And I think, because remember, we're all neuroscientists, and there is a very strong and large neuroscience community on campus that interacts within a graduate training program, the neuroscience training program. Now, that's not the only place I've met collaborators, but it's certainly a venue where you can find them.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a matter of, are you open to it? And then, once you find an area of interest, sorting out the guidelines or the rules that's going to govern your collaboration, if and when you get money, and if and when you get a student whom you share. Because those are things you should talk about at the beginning. Who's doing what? Who's paying for it? Who's in charge of paying for it? Those issues of control are the things I think that can damage collaborations when they haven't been established early on. And a student can fall through the cracks when it's not clear who's minding the shop. On the other hand, for a student, it can be wonderful because they can say, well, I'm going to so-and-so's lab for the day. And who knows where they are, but you believe they're there.
Now, speaking of students, talk about your teaching responsibilities and experience. Do you enjoy teaching?
I adore teaching. Of all the things I'm good at or not good at, teaching is the one thing that comes naturally to me. It's I just like talking. I like explaining things. I like laying it out in a logical progression. And I'm really excited about what I'm teaching about, which is neuroscience to first year veterinary students. So since the vet school opened, I've been teaching a 3-credit course in neuroanatomy, neurophysiology to first year veterinary students. And I've done it for 24 years, 25 years. And with 80 students every year, and they have to take it, I've basically taught every graduate veterinarian of the school, virtually. It's not that these students want to learn about how the nervous system works, and in fact many of them are a bit recalcitrant. You know, a hole in the head is a hole in the head. However, I enjoy pointing out to them that it's not just the animal's nervous system they're learning about. They're learning about themselves and how their brain works. And because they are professionals who will be encountering people, not just animals, people, for the rest of their lives, they will be asked, what do you think is happening to my granny's aunt who has X? It's just because you're in the medical profession, and veterinarians are very highly respected and trusted, they're going to be expected to know more than just what is wrong with the cat's leg or the, you know, the horse's belly. So I expect them to want to know more about how the nervous system operates and how it controls behavior and function in all of the animals they deal with, and also in the humans that they will deal with, including themselves. Mm-hmm. So I love teaching. I usually guest lecture in some undergraduate or graduate courses, but not a lot. And I think I would be lost without teaching. On the other hand, ironically, if given the choice tomorrow between you have to give up research or you have to give up teaching, I would give up teaching, because in research I still have something to prove to myself. Mm-hmm. And in teaching I don't have anything more to prove to myself. And I've been very well rewarded for teaching, because I've got a lot of teaching awards, both in the vet school and on campus. So, you know, I think you keep working on the thing that you are improving at. It's not that I don't keep working on improving at teaching, but I'm working in the 95 to 100% range, whereas in research I'm working in the 75 to 100% range. Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about other things that you've done on campus? Are you involved in, well, I know you were in the beginning, you said everybody was on some committee, even if you didn't know what the committee was doing. But talk about some of that work, your outside of teaching and research activities.
So I have served on innumerable committees in the department, the school, and the university. I have done a huge amount of service. And I was thinking back on that as to why, and I think it comes from the nuns, actually, because in our schooling there was a strong service sense that you had to give back, you had to work on behalf of the community that you were involved in, and the nuns always said you have to make a contribution. In life you have to make a contribution. Because as I look at my committee involvement, I've done, you know, there are times you think, why did you say yes to that, Mary? And it's just innate within me that I have to say yes before I consider saying no. So after serving on admissions committee, library committee, whatever else committees in the vet school pre-tenure, curriculum committee, oh, a million of them. Post-tenure, I was asked would I be interested in putting my name forward for the Biological Divisional Committee. Now, I knew they were the ones who looked at tenure documents, and having just prepared one, I had a pretty good idea of what it took to get there. So I put my name forward, and I was elected. And I found it intriguing that these were elected committees. These university level committees were all elected, whereas in the vet school they were appointed. The notion that your colleagues had a choice was very impressive, and that I had a community that I represented. So my community was not just the vet school, it was also the neuroscience community on campus, because this was the group of faculty with whom I mostly interacted academically. So I served on that committee for 3 years, and I think that that probably led to perhaps a couple of years later, I served on various other varieties of that level of committee. And then I got asked, would I put my name forward for the university committee? And that was a real eye-opener. I sort of knew what the university committee was. I was very flattered, a bit taken aback, and I went to ask somebody who had served on it what they thought. It happened to be Ron Schultz, who's chair in one of our vet school departments. And Ron said, it is the most amazing experience you will ever have in your life. You will never work as hard. It will eat you alive in terms of time. But it is like no other experience. It's just fantastic. So I agreed. My name went forward, and once again, I had a community who would be voting for me, because subsequently I have thought, who goes on these committees and why and how? And part of it is I have networked well at the university, but not deliberately. It's just I interact with a lot of people because of teaching, research, and service. So I served on the university committee for 3 years. And it was, exactly as Ron said, the most amazing experience, because you have this incredible top-down view of a city of 60,000 people, that's the university, and its relationship with so many aspects of the lives of those 60,000 people, from academics to financial to you name it, anything. It comes in front of the university committee. It's six people. They represent the university broadly. They're not all biologists or all physicists, but they're all quite different. They have a different set of experiences. They're totally committed to making it work better. They make no decisions. They only make recommendations. They're like a cabinet for the chancellor and the provost. They listen, they try to see every side of every problem and find a way to resolve it. But they never make a decision that is cast in stone, with the exception of extending someone's tenure clock. Those are the decisions that they make. But everything else is just, how can this be achieved? And they go to the Faculty Senate for approvals for everything. So it's an extraordinary body. It was a heady time. It took 10 to 12 hours a week. So with committee work, the university committee was the start, not the end or culmination. So once you do that, well, then you are out there and you are visible as being potentially useful on a number of other committees. So I have served on a variety of task forces and committees since then. And the most recent job I got was to chair the Provost Search Committee. And that was an extraordinary experience, which I, as I look back on it, I enjoyed an incredible group of people. That's the amazing thing with committees. You have people working with you who are so dedicated to the outcome. And the politics of it, for most of the committees I've served on, had no politics associated with them, no real politics that affected me. And in the case of selecting a provost, I didn't realize it naively, but yes, there is politics. So I continue to serve on committees, and I don't know what the next big challenge will be and whether I'll say yes or no, but knowing me, I'll probably say yes.
Would you talk about the climate for women here, and how does it help or hinder the participation of and achievement of women on campus?
For my own part, I've never been shy about being able to participate. And I think growing up in Ireland, in, you might call it a male-dominated society, but in fact it's somewhat matriarchal in its own way. So I had a very strong sense of self, and I had no misgivings about propelling myself to wherever I wanted to go. And I didn't think of myself as female or male, or that it was proportional. I never even thought about it. As a result, I've never felt any discrimination or any sense of there being a glass ceiling. But I do recognize that some people haven't had the life I've had, and they do see a glass ceiling. And if you see it, then you have to see that there are problems getting through it. And I recognize that for some people there are problems, that I'm not impervious to the fact that it can be a challenge. I'm glad I came up my way, that I didn't notice it, because if you don't notice it, yeah, you just muddle your way through. And for the most part, I think the campus is very sensitive to and responsive to this issue. The vet school has been extraordinarily positive. Even when, as we first took in a class, the ratio of males to females wasn't as extreme as it is now. Now it's very female dominated in our classes. And the faculty doesn't reflect that. It's still a generation behind. I'm certainly very conscious of this in my graduate students and postdocs, and I make every effort to accommodate their feminine lives and make it comfortable for them to be women in a scientific environment. So if they have child rearing or childbirth or issues associated with being female versus male, I'm very user friendly in my lab. I mightn't have been that way when I was 30.
Is there any problem for the profession that the student body is so female dominated?
I think there will be in the long run if there isn't more balance in senior levels of the profession. There's a problem for the academic side of the profession, not the profession per se, not the practice of veterinary medicine, for in fact it's a very user-friendly career for many women. They can step in and out of it for childbirth and child rearing. But if you go into academic veterinary medicine, it's rather like human medicine. You have to commit, and it's not, your residency is not perhaps optimal for childbirth. And then if you go into an academic environment where you're trying to get tenure, establish a research lab and do clinical work, it's very challenging, yes.
Well, let's switch directions here. Would you talk about professional organizations that you're involved in and why you're involved in them?
This harks back to the pedigree issue. I am a member of the Society for Neuroscience, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the Sleep Research Society, and the American Physiological Society. And these are my professional organizations, but I play no role in them other than I'm just a member of them. I've sometimes looked at them and thought, could you make your way on a series of committees to the middle or the top of these organizations? And I think having switched research directions so much and not having a strong US pedigree, it would be very difficult. So I haven't gone that direction.
Now, I know that you, as a faculty member, you do a lot of publishing. And have you ever been involved in editing journals or?
No, I've never been asked to be an editor of a journal. And I've published in perhaps 10, 15 different journals in the neuroscience range. And I think, once again, that goes back to I have jumped research areas. I've stayed in neuroscience, but I've moved through different systems. And so I don't have a strong track record in any one system. I've served on one NIH panel research grant evaluation as an ad hoc reviewer, and I've served on one NSF panel, again, as an ad hoc reviewer. And I think if I'd stayed in one area long enough, I probably would be tapped more frequently for editorial or review work.
Now, do you enjoy writing grants, writing articles?
I used not enjoy writing grants, and about 10 years ago, when money wasn't plentiful and I had to write a lot of grants in a two-year period, I just decided I needed an attitude adjustment, which was, you're going to love this. This is the most fun possible. You better enjoy it, because this is going to be part and parcel of your life. And in fact, it is rather fun getting your brain around a problem and looking at it logically and coming up with evidence as to why you would or wouldn't do certain experiments. So I enjoy it more and more now, and in fact look forward to writing another grant. But it's always fun to write a grant when you have a grant comfortably in hand. It's awful writing a grant when you know that the lives of three or four or five people in your lab depend on you getting their salaries.
It sounds, though, that you've been quite successful at it.
I stayed funded, except for one 3-year period where I didn't have a bean. And that was at the end of the visual neuroscience part, and before I got going on olfactory or respiratory. And that was a hard time. I lost part of my space. I was downsized, and that was perfectly reasonable. And I had an empty lab, and I had to do whatever had to be done myself, which made it quite slow. And it was a lonely time. And at the same time, I thought, okay, you know, you just get back in there and find something that works, and then you try and sell it. And this is totally possible. I think that comes back to, you know, this is America. I know it sounds trite, but, you know, this is America. You can do it there. I couldn't have done that in almost any other country in the world, I think.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk about awards and honors that you've received over the years?
The only awards I've ever got are for teaching. So I've received, in the School of Veterinary Medicine, there is an annual award for teaching called the Norden Distinguished Teaching Award. And I've received it twice and been runner-up for it twice. And then I received the Chancellor's Teaching Award, the Campus Chancellor's Teaching Award, which is an incredible honor because 5 or 6 of those are given out each year to the community of faculty, which is approximately 2,000 people. So I see that as my big career award.
Now, how does the Chancellor find you? Are you nominated?
You're nominated.
Okay.
So there's a call for nominations to every department every year, and your department nominates you and writes a long, detailed package of nomination with a lot of information, and some committee somewhere evaluates that and decides who gets these teaching awards. Mm-hmm. I think it's the Teaching Academy now. I haven't been on that committee to evaluate those ones.
Yet. Well, the last set of questions have to do with your life after work. If you would talk about your family, how do you balance your work and family? What do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working? How do you keep yourself healthy and energetic?
Everybody in my lab says, and people who, my graduate students say, that what they see in me is balance. And I think that my research career, teaching service, that reflects it. I do a lot of each, and nothing to exclusion. Outside of work, well, I got here and I realized you could do anything, so I learned how to fly. And I flew for about 20-odd years. And then somebody took me rock climbing, and I really liked it. So
now let's back up to this flying. Did you have your own plane?
No, I was in a club with a bunch of people. There were 14 guys and me in a club with 2 planes. And my dean was in the club as well, and the associate dean for research was in the club. And that's how I got into it, and we had 2 planes, and we could take them anywhere. And I got my instrument rating. And I did that on a trip flying around the United States with an instructor in a small plane. And so I flew just for pleasure. And after about 15 or so years, I realized I wasn't flying a lot. Competing demands on time. Mm-hmm. And you either do it a lot or you don't do it. So gradually I decided either I was going to build a plane, and that way I wouldn't have to worry about doing damage to the one that I was sharing with people, or else quit. So I got a plane kit. And I started on the kit, and then I met the person that I have spent the last 10 years with and will spend the remaining years with. And so he sort of took the place of a Kit Fox airplane kit. He knows this.
I see.
So that ended flying, and I sold the kit.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when I came to Madison, I started rock climbing. And rock climbing was my passion for about 20 years. And I went to Devil's Lake both days, every weekend. I've climbed all over the U.S. I had a great group of people to climb with, and they mostly hung out where I lived at weekends because it was close to Devil's Lake. I bought a settler's log cabin located between Mesimane and Sauk City, which would be halfway between the rock climbing area and the university. And the log cabin needed work, and the rock climbers needed a place to stay. And the two worked out perfectly. So I got a lot of work done. And I'd always wanted land. So I have 30 acres and cabin. And the cabin has grown and been added on to, and it has central air and central heating. It's quite respectable.
Doesn't sound like a cabin anymore.
No, it doesn't sound like
home,
But we gave it a 150th birthday party 2 years ago because it genuinely deserved it. And there's a log barn there, and we've restored prairie there. And so there was that. Mm-hmm. So then I've always competed at something. So I trained and did a couple of triathlons. And I also played squash for several years and competed here on campus in the squash league and the like. And then, you know, I'm not ready for golf yet. So I was thinking, I took up mountain biking and did a lot of mountain bike racing. And I still have a mountain bike, and I thought, well, maybe road racing or maybe just road rides is better. So now I'm training for a century ride, but I picked the flattest century in Wisconsin, which is in Door County in September.
Oh,
so I'm training for that. So that's what I do. And I have a lot of friends from different walks of life, and we entertain a lot. And I travel as much as I can. I read as much as I can. And let's see.
Are your parents still living?
No, my parents are both deceased. My mother about 3 years ago and my father about 10 years ago. However, when they were alive in Ireland, I was going back to Ireland very frequently. So when my mother was in a nursing home, I was returning 3 times a year. So that didn't leave much time for other trips.
Right.
And now I travel for work, but I also very definitely want to travel for vacations. And I've traveled a lot already. So
Where are your favorite places?
I still love going back to Ireland, and I still have a house there. I'll be going to Tasmania and New Zealand in December, and that's a return trip because they're wonderful. I love places where there aren't other people. So it's hard to go places where there aren't other people anymore. I'm not a fan of cities except for short periods of time. So my travels are usually to try to find remote places where I don't have to struggle anymore. I do actually like a bit of comfort. Don't want to necessarily camp. But at the same time, I think I'm going to be going down the Grand Canyon next year. So that'll be camping, but it'll be a trip led by somebody. So somebody will cook.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That's good. And where does your sister live?
She lives in Canada. And she's a scientist. She's an entomologist working for the Canadian government. She'll retire next year. And as I look to my sister as my bellwether for many, many things, I will probably watch her closely in retirement and see what she does and see whether I would want to have a retirement like that, or maybe never have a retirement. And I don't know. I honestly don't know.
And what does your partner do?
He works for the State Historical Society. He's an architectural historian. And I think it's a great combination, not having two scientists in the one house. So this way, he's utterly ignorant of biology. And fortunately, reasonably fascinated by it. I'm utterly ignorant of architectural history. All of those years that I didn't spend with a decent liberal arts education. And so I'm patient and willing to learn. And it works out great.
Now I have to ask you, because you're part of the School of Veterinary Medicine, do you have any pets?
Like everybody in the School of Veterinary Medicine, one acquires pets.
Uh-huh.
So about 14 years ago, somebody brought up a dog from our spay and neuter program to my lab and said, Mary, you have to. You just have to. So I did. I had to. And I took Cara home. And for 13 and a half years, we had a wonderful relationship. She was a mutt, but a great border collie mutt. And her life ended last year, and it was a great life, I've no doubts. She had 30 acres and total freedom, and me at her disposal for as much time as I could give.
Yeah.
And she seemed to appreciate it. So I'm taking a break. I'm not ready for a pet yet. I know a pet will find me, mm-hmm. the same way that Kara found me, and that'll be grand.
So that's fairly common around here.
Oh, right? Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. There's always somebody looking for home for uh-huh. some animal, and generally they find homes okay. for those animals. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's the end of the questions, but I won't turn this off. If you'd like, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you would like to talk about before we end?
I'd like to just say that if anyone listens to this tape, that I've had an incredible opportunity at this university. I didn't dream that my life would be like this. It has been unbelievably satisfying. And I do credit the university. The university consists of people, but it also consists of a history and an attitude and a sustained effort to make it an incredible environment for the people who are students here and to work here. And I think it has succeeded. I've established an amazing loyalty for this university, way more than the place where I did my bachelor's degree and PhD. And, you know, I've no children, and it's likely that the university will benefit when I die, but it should. I think that it has allowed me to live an amazingly fulfilled life. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for doing this.